Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankluik, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
The first part is about giving people the opportunity to share their testimony, their experience of what it was like experiencing racism, and also what to contribute to what action needs to happen.
A year ago, the federal government launched the first national anti-racism plan. Has it worked? We have all the details. Also, what's the impact of Australia and the Pacific at COP31 in Turkey next year? And later today...
We went out to try and find an look at something to replace it. And when we go out to look for costings on it, it comes back at $40 million. Well, that's a price escalation from 2019.
A local council is looking to build an aquatic centre, but the price of building it has doubled. So what's next? We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, the Coalition at Parliament House have ditched their net zero targets while the federal government's overhauled Environmental Protection Bill has passed. As this happens in Canberra, an advocacy group is making the most of the news cycle. Climate 200 has sponsored 35 candidates at the last election, with a campaign proving to be successful. The Canavan Climate Trust's aim is to target advertising in marginal seats, with quotes taken from Queensland Senator Matt Canavan calling for new coal power stations. Community Radio Network's political reporter Noah Secum spoke with new co-convener of Climate 200 and former independent candidate for Calair, Kate Hook, about the campaign.
It's not really a change of approach. I think some of the things that we do at Climate 200 are in response to just our supporters and people who we're talking to being absolutely outraged by the level of misinformation and, you know, just the ridiculous claims that are often made by members of the coalition. And Matt Canavan's name just kind of keeps coming up, you know, talking about exact opposite about what net zero is actually, because we all know that net zero is a massive economic opportunity for Australians, and to abandon it as they have is just squandering that opportunity. So I think in response, there was a thought like, let's just collect all these ridiculous, outlandish statements and then make it very clear to the voting public that this is what elected officials are saying. And so we wanted to highlight that.
And that does remind me that, yes, during the election campaign, you did have the advertisements with, you know, kids reading quotes from, I believe it was the Liberals and the Nationals. Do you know how that particular campaign went, whether that was an effective way to cut through to people that perhaps hadn't engaged before?
Look, I think it was just in the moment. And so it did have traction in the moment as well. So it's certainly not, it's not a massive feature of our strategy. For example, we've launched the Community Accelerator Fund recently. That is a much bigger part of our strategy. People are sick of having elected representatives who either are ignorant of the science, so let's just say that that could be the case, or are deliberately misleading the public. And I don't know which is worse. What is the bigger concern? It's someone who can't find the credible information to make good decisions, or someone who does know the credible information and just refuses to use it.
I also want to go to your experience as a candidate running in a regional seat of New South Wales as an independent. For two elections now, how much has the climate debate come up, for starters, but also how much of that has changed as you've spoken to people over time?
The electorate that I ran in is called Calair, and it is, if people know, it's Lithgow, Bathurst, Orange, Mudgee, that sort of area of New South Wales, central west New South Wales. In that area, there's both a renewable energy zone. So that's an area where lots of solar and wind and battery projects are being developed, and it's massive capital flowing into that area, like an economic opportunity unlike we've seen in generations. But at the same time, there are two coal mining communities in Lithgow and in Mudgee, where there needs to be a transition. So people who've for decades been employed in those industries need new jobs and need to be supported in that. So it was very much an important topic in my electorate. It's interesting. There's been some research put out recently, and I can forward you the document, Noah, that shows that the people who live within renewable energy zones, the proportion that support renewable energy, I'm going to say is around about 65%. I'll find you the exact figure. But there's a perception in the community that most people don't support it. Does that make sense? Like if you ask actually people, do you support it? You get that high figure. And then if you ask people, how many people in this community support it? You get a low figure. So it tells us that misinformation is something important to combat because it could delay these projects. One other thing that people did talk about a lot though, and I totally agree with this, is that renewables have to be done right. So, you know, the communities who are hosting this infrastructure need to feel that it's happening with them and not happening to them.
The fact that we're having this debate at all, the fact that we're looking at what an opposition policy is, maybe 2.5 years out from the next election. So I guess mm-hmm. what is the urgency to addressing some of this misinformation and the concerns that you've raised?
Yeah, I think it's around the what we know about misinformation itself. Let's think about it. If I were to sort of just off the top of my head offer a counter campaign, I would be linking the words, a word like investment and prosperity, which is actually the opportunity that we're talking about here. We know that electricity bills will come down, and the only way they will come down is with the cheapest form of electricity, which we know is electricity generation, which we know is renewable energy. So imagine we've built the solar farms, we've built the wind turbines, we've built the batteries. What's the cost of the wind? What's the cost of the sun? Zero. So let's now just look at another scenario. Just say we were going to build these new coal-fired power stations. So again, massive infrastructure build, massive cost to do that. And then what's the cost of the ongoing inputs to that? Huge cost.
Kate Hook from Climate 200 there, speaking with CRN's Noah Seckham. For this and more about the topic, check out From Pillar to Post, wherever you get your podcasts. In late 2024, the Australian Human Rights Commission launched the country's first national anti-racism plan, with 63 recommendations for a whole society approach to eliminating the issue. A year on, and civil society groups say the federal government has taken no action on the framework, with over 50 organizations urging the government to immediately fund and implement the roadmap. The Wire's Emma Watsky spoke with Deputy CEO of the Refugee Council of Australia, Adama Kamara, to hear more on the community's consensus.
I think that the joint statement that we released was over 60 organisations have signed on to it. And it's really what we're clearly saying is that, one, we commend the government for showing leadership in commissioning the framework to be drafted, but the leadership has stopped in just the drafting of the statement. We want them to continue to the next phase in acknowledging it, but also funding it for implementation. Racism is something that the communities we work with experience every day. It's a significant impact on their lives, and we just want the government to show leadership by funding it.
I understand there were 63 recommendations in the commission. What do you want to see most implemented from the roadmap in order to address racism in Australia?
So the first recommendation is that the government should acknowledge that the framework has been developed and respond to it formally. And the second recommendation is actually funding a task force. So the task force would be responsible for overseeing the implementation of the framework. And those two points are the main two. I think once those two are actually actioned, then the rest of the other actions can be implemented.
And the Australian Human Rights Commission created the framework following community and sector consultations over several years. Why do you think that community consultation was so invaluable in constructing the framework? And what were some of perhaps your objectives or your organisation's objectives in the community consultation process?
The first part is about giving people the opportunity to share their testimony, their experience of what it was like experiencing racism, and also what to contribute to what action needs to happen for change to occur. So I think it's giving the power to the community to say, tell us how you experience racism, but also tell us what you think needs to happen for racism to be addressed in Australia. We took part in that. We involved refugee and asylum seeking communities in that because we've seen repeatedly how it impacts their sense of belonging and their ability to fully settle in Australia. So it was really important that the community consultation was so extensive. Without consultation, I don't think the framework would be as strong as what it is now, because it actually responds to real life situations that communities across Australia have said they experience when it comes to racism.
The Commission heard that First Nations and other negatively racialised people, that systemic and structural racism is deeply embedded throughout Australia. What has been the impacts of systemic racism, and what structural reforms are necessary, or what would they look like in your opinion?
I think our main work as refugee council is working with refugees and people seeking asylum. And what we hear clearly is, as newcomers to Australia, it's obvious to us that the way Australia is set up has not been set up for the First Nations peoples. You can see the barriers in access to education and even the outcomes. You can see barriers to employment. In all aspects of life, you can see how the systems that have been set up are negatively impacting First Nations people. And it's really clear from the consultations that we had, if that is not addressed, newcomers like us will also be part of that system. Addressing racism is not only going to have better outcomes for First Nations, but also newcomers like us from refugee and asylum seeking backgrounds in Australia.
On that note, what impacts has racism or racist behaviour or language had on people who are needing to resettle in the country and create community and sense of belonging in a new place, especially if they are refugees?
So one of the things we hear all the time from refugee communities is that whilst, you know, their journey to Australia has not been an easy one, they've faced significant challenges and threat to life. Arriving in Australia, they felt they were going to be safe, you know, chance to start a new life, rebuild what everything that they've lost. But one of the hindrances to that new life is actually how they've been treated because of their race, and that intersection of race and refugee status as well. That's actually hindered their ability to feel like they belong to Australia. We've had people who'd say, look, if I'd known it was going to be like this, I wouldn't have come. I thought I would be safe in Australia, but I don't feel safe. I don't feel like I belong. I don't even feel comfortable to go outside or engage in day-to-day activities like joining a sports club because of the racism I experience there, or going shopping because of the abuse they receive, or suspicion that they're going to steal something, and so on. What we're hearing really strongly is that people don't feel safe coming to Australia in day-to-day activities, in addition to the systemic challenges they experience.
And what's it like for you to hear those sorts of impacts?
I feel as a nation we can do better. We can do better because we have put our hand up to say, yep, we are party to the Refugee Convention. We've made a commitment to protect people who are in need of safety, in need of protection. Yet after arrival, they're not getting that protection. They might be safe in a sense of, you know, there might not be that physical harm, but that psychological harm that comes with racism is just as damaging. So it makes me angry that we as a country are not treating people with respect and dignity, and discrimination still exists.
That was Deputy CEO of the Refugee Council of Australia, Adama Kamara, speaking with The Wire's Emma Watsky. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC. To our listeners in Mount Gambier on 5GTRFM. And to the other side of the country in Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. Turkey will be the official host country for the COP31 climate summit following a highly contested bidding process against Australia and the Pacific Island nations. Australia and the Pacific region will still play important roles for the COP31 summit following a new, unique compromise with Turkey. But without Australia and the Pacific in the driver's seat, what impact will the loss have on the region? To find out this answer and more, I spoke with Director of the University of New South Wales Centre for Sustainable Development Reform, Eliza Northrop.
I don't think the Australian government ever really dropped its bid. I mean, the bid was in place for many years. Australia was indicating that it was very keen to co-host COP31, certainly with the Pacific. It never dropped the bid, but I think the issue or what's led to the arrangements that we now have is that Turkey also didn't drop its bid. And ultimately, the COP presidency process is done by consensus. It really came down to diplomatic efforts from both countries to have their bid be successful. And the fact that neither country was really willing to step down from its bid is the reason why we have this new and unprecedented arrangement between Turkey and Australia.
So, Eliza, with this new unique agreement with Turkey, what do you think is the impact of losing the summit as sole hosts mean for Australia and the Pacific Islands?
Yeah, so I think the opportunity to be the COP president and to host the COP in your country, in your region, really offers tremendous benefit in terms of putting a spotlight on both your own country's priorities, actions and needs, as well as really shaping the agenda for that year. You know, what initiatives get advanced, how you structure the negotiations, but also how you structure the other part of a COP, which is the action agenda. And the action agenda is really where new initiatives announced, new funding commitments. You know, we saw a great example of that at COP30 recently, where Brazil was the COP president, announced the Tropical Forest Financing Facility, a tremendously innovative and exciting new initiative around climate finance. So being COP presidency really gives you that very broad scope to advance really impactful and long-lasting change for not only your country, but your region and the priorities that are most dear to your country. So Australia, in losing that opportunity, really isn't in the driving seat for COP31 anymore. Obviously, as part of that arrangement that was negotiated in the final days of COP30 with Turkey, Turkey will be the COP31 president. They will host the COP, so they will really be in the driving seat around the nomination of key high-level champions, of key priorities, of where the COP is situated and what that conveys to the international community. But the key part of that deal is that Australia has been delegated a role within that, and they will be president for the negotiations, which is one aspect of what makes up a COP, you know, that government-led negotiation process to agree decision text that is then formally adopted by the Conference of the Parties. So Australia will have carriage and responsibility for driving a subset of COP31, which it can certainly use to its advantage to make sure that its priorities are really reflected in that document, but it has lost that overarching responsibility. And I think your question also asked about the loss of the Pacific, and I think this loss is quite substantial and quite significant, and it really is a loss for Australia as well, because Australia's bid from the start was all about a regional COP, which really would have been the first of its kind between Australia and between the Pacific, co-hosting arrangements that really offered the opportunity to amplify and elevate Pacific priorities. And, you know, the Pacific really has been leaders for the entire 30 plus years of the UNFCCC, really bringing some of the most innovative ideas and actions and being continual champions for climate action. So Australia really stood to gain a lot from that close partnership. Now, the Pacific obviously will host the pre-COP, which is a very senior head of delegation ministerial meeting in advance of COP that helps set the political agenda. So that will be critical, but unfortunately, two's company, three's a crowd, as the saying goes, and we now have three different arrangements. So I think Australia really needs to make sure that it follows through on that long-standing commitment to co-host with the Pacific and really look for ways to amplify the impact of the pre-COP, but also to amplify the Pacific voice at COP31 itself, which will be more difficult given that essentially now we're looking at co-hosting arrangements ultimately between Turkey and Australia.
In future, when can Australia and the Pacific get another opportunity to host? Like, when can that opportunity present itself?
So next year, as we've talked about, Turkey will be the president. He'll be hosted in Turkey with the arrangements with Australia and the Pacific in place. COP31, then the presidency will be held in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa. So essentially the way that this works is around the responsibility for COP presidency rotates through the UNFCCC regional groupings. There's five regional groupings. Australia is part of Western Europe and others, group, which is why it was a choice between Turkey and Australia. So that's how that came about. And then it's going into the Africa regional group as COP32, as I said again, and then it will cycle through the other regional groups. So about another 5 years, essentially.
That was Eliza Northrop from the UNSW Center for Sustainable Development Reform, ending the report. A local council in regional Queensland is putting a much-needed infrastructure project on hold due to high costs. Quilpie, 1,000 kilometres west of Brisbane, has been planning an aquatic centre for over 20 years to replace the actual pool. Before COVID, cost to build a centre was $20 million. Now, the amount has doubled, leaving plans on hold until further notice, or until the state government supports the project. The Y's Eduardo Jordan started asking Mayor of Quilpie Shire Council, Ben Hall, to explain what's going on with the actual pool.
Yeah, so this has been a long-running saga. It's been on our wish list, build a new aquatic centre, for nearly 25 to 30 years, just because our pool, as all things age, we keep throwing Band-Aids at it to keep it going along. So, yeah, we went out to try and find an look at something to replace it. And when we go out to look for costings on it, it comes back at $40 million. Well, that's a price escalation from 2019, was the last time council went out to look at prices on the aquatic centre, and it was $20 million back then. So it's doubled in that time.
So what's the pool looking like as we speak?
It is a very nice, well-maintained, clean facility. It's well utilised by the community, but it's a lot of the infrastructural assets behind it that keep it running from day to day are deteriorating, and a lot of them are in the ground and unserviceable and unmaintainable. And so it's only as it has aged, it is one of those things that it'll end up with a critical failure one time, and generally when you need it most, and that'll be during the summer months.
So the Shire Council proposed an aquatic centre over there. So why is it important to have this centre and not just a pool renovation?
Yeah, it's about when, if not now, when do you go through the process of replacing that asset for the community? And that can's been kicked down the road for quite a few years now. So, you know, we're all getting to that point now where it's going to have to happen. So we're mindful of what the community needs are and what the community can afford.
If you can explain as well to us, I mean, us, for example, in Brisbane and in metropolitan areas, I mean, if there's not a pool, you know, available, I mean, we can just go to another one. But I'm guessing it's like the main pool in the Shire. Why is this very important for the community?
Yeah, it's where people learn to swim. Also, they facilitate things like first aid lessons and things like that out of there. So it's not just an aquatic centre for swimming. It's a learning centre for learners learn to swim and for the first aid delivery for the community, which, you know, is facilitated there. There's all of those sort of things tied through it. And the importance of it is we live in a rural area where there are country kids who come in to learn to swim here. Every property has a dam within 50 metres of their house or a cattle trough or something. So it's just absolutely paramount that kids learn to swim in regional areas.
Now, $40 million, that's a substantial amount of money. How is this news of the very expensive aquatic centre affecting the community, especially this summer?
Yeah, the effect on the community is not that apparent at the moment because we have a pool, we have it up and running. We had a major shutdown and a breakdown early in the season, thankfully. In October, it was still remained relatively cool, but had it have been a normal year, it would have been warm and everyone would have been looking for it. But yeah, but that just, you know, that was at the start of the year and start of the season rather. And then all of a sudden, we're looking down the barrel of a hot, long summer and everyone's on tenterhooks as to whether the pool is going to endure and see us through the summer. So, you know, I think for the community and the assurity of the pool going forward, a new aquatic centre is the best thing we can look at for reliability and more capacity to offer more services, more accessibility for our ageing community and those sort of things.
Now, have you approached the state government about this project? And if so, what's their feedback on it?
We haven't gone out. We've just looked at preliminary costings and drawn upon other community like ours in our region that have actually initiated doing pool building. And worked out our estimates based on that and got estimates from those contractors to look at the feasibility of what it would entail for us to build a new aquatic centre here, then making that a part of our application for advocation of how we get funding to build it. And when we look at it at 40, it comes back at 39, almost $40 million, and the cost escalation going up. What would we go out to market to look for? Because you just can't get a bearing on the cost.
Mayor of Quilpie Shire Council, Ben Hall there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, Sin Media in Melbourne, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you in 2026, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to hear any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries, where this program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluk. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next year. And with that said, we wish you all a very happy summer break.